Welcome to the Yale Founders Series, where we bring you in-depth interviews with Yale alumni, founders, and CEOs
to share their insights from developing and scaling avant-garde ideas.
I'm Nathaniel Johnson.
And I'm Yolanda Derevyanko.
And we hope to encourage an innovative mindset
by sharing invaluable lessons from our conversations to inspire those who might be dissuaded from pursuing their entrepreneurial dreams.
Sean Huntoft, an expert in household finance, has an experience as an investor, research, and originator. With a background in mortgage lending and customer acquisitions, he understands the challenges of online borrowing advice. Sean has studied household credit use at the New York Fed, earned his PhD at Yale, and even served as a mortgage professor at NYU Stern. As the founder of Solve Finance, he aims to optimize household finances through market data and technology, ensuring stress-free and ideal borrowing outcomes for his clients. Thank you for coming on to the Founder Series. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's a great thing to have. I'm so glad we're doing this at Yale now.
So let's just dive straight into it. Can you tell us a bit about how you, like, what's your background and how you got into entrepreneurship and what inspired you maybe to start Solve Finance?
Yeah. Really explaining me and what I've studied explains my motivation for Solve Finance. So as an undergrad, I studied computer science and specifically human-computer interaction and how to help people by automating things for them. Mm-hmm. So I used to do computer-integrated surgery. I actually have a published paper or two in the area.
That's
pattern recognition to help surgeons perform surgery. After computer science, I got into finance. And, you know, personally, my parents lost the family home. Every single one of my three brothers ran into credit problems. I ended up investing in consumer finance and seeing borrowers make mistakes. And so I guess I had the pattern matching of like, oh, hey, I used to help automate these better outcomes in medicine and surgery. Why isn't anyone doing that for people? And my first approach was pursuing research, pointing out that people aren't robots and computers and how they make mistakes and are behavioral, as we'd say in an academic setting or in, you know, to normal people, we'd say how they're human. And I did a PhD at Yale and then was at the New York Fed as a researcher, an adjunct mortgage professor at NYU Stern. And then I came into the startup world ended up running D2C acquisitions at Better Mortgage, a big mortgage fintech here in New York City. And I left that to pursue Solve Finance, which is precisely that automated liability manager for households that takes the complexity off of the user's hands. So rather than providing financial education or materials or asking someone to do a PhD studying, financial math, we actually do that for them. So sort of you can think of it as like a Google Maps for borrowing or like a Betterment for debt. So you have, all these complexities and institutional details that you need to know. You need to know where market prices are for everything. And we have all of that.
You were starting off by working across so many different niches as well as different approaches and how you studied them to eventually find the solution that you are working on right now. And what do you think would be the most transferable skill that you got or skills?
So I view it as I was doing I had a similar hammer ever since I was an undergrad, which is doing smart things with data. So when I was investor, you know, I started off on a fixed income trading desk. And what were we doing? We were using Kalman filters to estimate the price of a bond, given all these different broker feeds and different levels of noise. And it's sort of like estimating the position of a rocket when you have different sensors. Or it was, you know, spotting arbitrage opportunities, which is basically spotting mistakes in the market. So yeah, the transferable skills and really what I developed as an undergrad and then, you know, just did more of as an MBA or a PhD was taking data that's relevant to a problem, asking questions, you know, maybe they might be research questions or they're a business question like, why are our leads converting at lower rates today? You know, if you're running a mortgage fintech, or why is conversion low? Why? How do we describe user engagement with our sales team? And how can we create a metric of engagement to communicate about the engagement internally as a business? So sort of like business intelligence applications. These days, I guess a lot of that would be called data science or machine learning. But really, it's just being smart with data and, curious about questions. So that's another transferable skill, but maybe it's more of a trait.
Mm-hmm. And these traits and skills would be setting apart successful entrepreneurs and people who don't really succeed in entrepreneurship.
I think, and just like talking about just the intersection kind of finance and technology, I think it's really cool how like finance, I think, has been like a long established industry, right? But recently with technology, being able to like analyze this data so we can automate this, etc. I guess kind of the skills in general, like as you talked about the niche of fintech, what skills would separate success in the fintech industry, like specifically in terms of like, would you need more analytical skills in terms of data, or kind of like be able to see a broader picture in how, I guess, we're looking at like scaling sort of certain industries in the finance realm, and having that vision is more prominent of a factor?
Yeah. I'd answer maybe going back to an earlier question of yours as well that I didn't fully answer, which is, you know, like what drew me to entrepreneurship myself rather than, you know, continuing to work at an established startup, which is the drive to want to see something exist. Mm-hmm. So you see, in my case, you know, personally, I see people making huge financial mistakes, being in financial distress, getting materially worse outcomes, choosing the wrong products, you know, paying too much on debts. On the other hand, lenders having all the information and data and people like me working for them to optimize their businesses. There's no one working, you know, just purely automating better borrowing outcomes. There's lots of advertising platforms out there, you know, that you run into if you have a boring question. But really, I didn't see, you know, what I had in my head. And I think that's a common theme for entrepreneurs. You know, something's in their head and they want to see it exist. That might, like, that's not the Y Combinator school of entrepreneurship. You know, that the Y Combinator is, you know, you do customer surveys, you don't have an idea yourself, maybe, you know, people tell you what they want, you build into that, and you immediately have a customer from day one. That's not, like, I'm not saying that that's a bad model, but in reality, I think most, because entrepreneurship is hard, probably most people that get into it is they really want to see something. They really want to have a baby, and they're going to have a baby no matter what anyone tells them. Secondary to that, you know, is you don't give up and just grit and doing it without waiting for the perfect answer. That's probably another common thing that I see amongst my fellow founders. And, you know, clearly, it's useful because if you're unlikely to give up, you're going to survive for longer. You know, you don't, the going's going to be hard often, many times before you break through the early stages. So not giving up or grit is probably a really useful thing to have in you.
Yeah. And then what do you believe sets your company apart from other fintech companies? And how have you leveraged maybe that unique positioning that you have for your advantage, for the company's advantage?
Yeah, the unique differentiator for us from the big guys, and so big guys are people like NerdWallet, LendingTree, Bankrate. If you've heard of them, you might not have, because you might not shop for many loans. But these are the websites that are D2C and you run into online. The difference for us is we aren't advertising platforms, so their objective function, to use an economist's phrase, is to, you know, maximize ad revenue. That's their only source of revenue. Our outcomes are user outcomes, and we want to get paid, if we are paid by businesses when we're B2B, which is our only source of monetization today, is businesses where it's in their interest that users have a better outcome. So what's an example of that? lenders that have denied a user and want their debt-to-income ratios and credit scores to be improved, or employers that want financial health benefits or financial wellness providers and where the debt expertise that some broader financial advisor taps into, a fiduciary. So that's what distinguishes us from the big guys. There's lots of startups tackling debt as a problem. Most of them are either payments or student loan specific. And we aren't payments. We're like a portfolio manager, your liabilities manager, looking across your portfolio of debts. And we're broader. We aren't just student loans. We sort of sit on top of all the debts and see, you know, we might recommend student loan debt forgiveness, but we haven't built that machinery. Someone else has. We see, you know, a rate for a student loan, but we also see rates for auto and personal loans. So that's what distinguishes us from newer fellow startups.
Yeah, no, it seems somewhat analogous to, like, I would say, like, you know, some sort of subscription manager system, such as like Chargebee, where they're like, they'll have all these different subscriptions you have, and they'll kind of see, there's that kind of analogous to the loaning system. You mentioned also machine learning, artificial intelligence. So, like, in incorporating that, is there sort of like, is that kind of also a unique aspect that you guys having? Because I think if you're having someone like almost as like a personal assistant, right, through AI, that's kind of managing that through, I think it'd be very valuable to have someone like telling you the back of your ear, oh, you know, you need to pay out this loan, who's going to do it, etc.
Yeah, exactly. So some of that, yeah, some of that is just financial math. And other parts get into the world of machine learning, like when you're estimating the likely outcome for a user and you've seen other users' outcomes, right? That's like, it could be as simple as running a regression, which is machine learning. And so using users' data to help other users, that's where the ML comes in. And then, yeah, there's just a layer of financial machinery. So in the thing that distinguishes, when you asked, I answered the question of like, what sets us apart from other startups? I was describing what sets us apart in terms of the product. You could think of it in terms of the team as well. And it's, you know, I don't know many startups that have, you know, a PhD in financial economics or people. Like, our team is a lot more like the analytics, like trading desk quant team 20 years ago at my first investment bank than it is a typical startup. A typical startup, and it's especially D2C, you have a team that's really good at, you know, like optimizing your flows, optimizing the performance of advertising. They're great acquisition machines. What we have is a great, yes, financial math machine.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like just having a service like that that can just kind of spit out sort of facts in terms of what to do next is just so valuable in that industry, because like the amount of this data as well. In terms of like, I would say traction wise, like how are you guys kind of able to appeal to say, you know, we offer this unique service and this is how we're going to be able to benefit you, right? Because I feel like although you can, you know, maybe mention AI, et cetera, it'd be kind of hard to just get someone to kind of agree with that, I would say.
Yeah. So by being smart with your credit data and the market, we on average so far increased the amount of home you can buy by 29%.
Okay.
So our other KPI is how much money we can identify for you to save.
Okay.
And
is there,
like, with being live for a year, we've unlocked about $9 million in savings so far. So yeah, those are our main user goals that we take, you know, for an end borrower. Is they either want to save money, and that could be monthly money or total expected cost of debts, or they want to maximize the home they can buy. And so those are our key metrics.
Yeah.
And in terms of B2B traction, you know, we're live with Better Mortgage. We closed with Morty, Franklin Credit. These are mortgage lenders.
Yeah.
And then we have some financial wellness providers too.
Yeah. And I'm also really curious, how do you balance the need and sort of the fast-paced and innovative technology that's emerging and that you're incorporating in data analysis with the importance of kind of maintaining trust and security and trustworthiness with your users, for your users?
Yeah. I mean, it, like, the, it, that is a challenge or a problem that will never be perfectly solved, and you're always trying to just do the best that you can, especially if you're a new young startup that people haven't heard
of.
One benefit of going B2B for us is we're being introduced and having handoffs from someone that they already have some relationship of trust with. So for instance, a typical mortgage lender handoff to us is, hey, we couldn't approve you for a loan today. We noticed that you had a debt that we, you know, identified an issue with your debt to income ratio, that your monthly payments were too high. We'd love you to work with our trusted partner, Soul Finance, to improve your situation so that we can lend you tomorrow. And so that handoff, you know, it's sort of a passing of trust. And I think that's key in handoffs between startups. So for instance, we are recommending options to our users, and we're working with those partners in order to have more people take them up. Because once the user's in Solve, it's actually like one of our challenges at the moment is we want more people going off to providers for student loan debt forgiveness for a specific credit score reporting. But it's like they trust us, and getting them to take that next step is sort of our challenge. So our challenge at the moment is more, how do we get them to trust other people that we've vetted and think are good options for them?
Yeah, and on that note, what do you think are some of the main challenges that the fintech industry is going to be facing in the next 2 years and that emerging entrepreneurs would hopefully solve, and how would they solve them?
Yeah, I should have prepared an answer to this question. On that, a big one. I mean, immediate things are the interest rate environment and the economy. We've started to see, you know, blow-ups or people going out of business, especially on the lending side. Anyone that has assets and anyone that is exposed to houses will have an increasingly challenging time. So you're going to see a reordering. I'm not sure if they'll find it harder to get venture funding, but definitely just in terms of their business outcomes, that's going to be challenging. And that historically has been a pretty like easy startup to do because you show revenue day one. People always want money. So you can start up a lending business. You're showing revenue. You know, you raise more dollars, lend to people, and then everything's fine until it's not. And this is one of those times where it's not. And so you start to see defaults, and that's going to be a challenge. I think there's bigger things for people to be doing. I think, you know, my take is you tend to be rewarded, and it's easy to go after small things. I could imagine young entrepreneurs going after some bigger things in this, like this is sort of an opportunity. Like everything's going to be difficult, so why not go for the big thing that's huge and ambitious? I don't have a crystal ball on the supply of venture funding. It could be that more things have to be bootstrapped. I imagine there's going to be fewer, you know, copycats that like print something like another neobank out. So that could, I think that's going to be a good thing because young people aren't going to be encouraged to just do a copy and paste template of something that exists. They're going to be challenged to actually do something more innovative and bigger than maybe you could like get away with and actually do an okay business with the last couple of years.
And the timing is so important to know when to go in and go out and do it and take that opportunity and start something. And right now with interest rates and inflation and all of the uncertainty around new emerging spheres and people just not sure what to bet on, what not to bet on, do you think this is a way to sort of chill down or actually grab that opportunity and go out and start something? Do you view that this as a challenge or an opportunity?
Just to add to that real quick, actually, because I was at this panel yesterday, right, for the Sci Accelerator. They were mentioning, as you mentioned, the kind of like that curve of innovation, right? As we're going into an economic recession, you have I guess the funding kind of is limited, right? So as you were saying, it's going to kind of push the best and brightest ideas out there. So Yeah, like in that niche of fintech, I think we kind of relate to that same sort of aspect as that kind of like having the best ideas float to the top rather than just being a funny for all.
Yeah, I think you're going to have more like both. It's going to be a selection bias and you're going to get people who only really want to do something. Plus, it's only the best things are going to make it through the funnel. I think I view it as more of an opportunity for people who are interested in innovation. Outcomes are going to be less driven by the easy money that we had or easier money on the funding side. Capital is going to be costly for everyone. I think that's an opportunity for innovation. You're going to really, need to mean it to start something. It's definitely going to be a good thing for consumers. I don't think consumers or like society benefits from having, so many very similar competing things. Consumers are probably just more confused by the number of options. Like another way of looking at it is fintech has probably just made things more confusing and complicated for the usual household, the typical household. Maybe one opportunity the next couple of years is going to be people simplifying things and, right, like being the portal to that complexity. Solve finance is just like a piece of that on the debt side, but there's much bigger opportunity to, be a trusted advisor. Back to that other question, maybe there's an opportunity for fintechs not to be scammy, make as much money quickly machines, and think a bit more about the longer term and really big outcomes 5 to 10 years from now rather than just an immediate round and an immediate fundraise in the next 6 to 12 months.
I'm kind of curious like of how this sort of precedent now of having the best ideas float to the top is going to be a trend to see in the future.
What would you say is the defining factor that distinguishes successful entrepreneurs who actually succeed in these very uncertain times versus those that don't?
It probably takes a lot more harder choices and making the hard choices quicker. There's less room for error. You have to be ruthless on spend and economics to make it through the hard times. So that's probably a differential thing today compared to, when times are easy and the outlook is bright and rosy. But at times like this compared to other times, it's just quicker to be, ruthless, not in a bad way. Ruthless might be the wrong word, but don't have the time or the safety cushion to, you have to be quicker to make turns, I think, on the economics side today.
I think it's so interesting to see. I don't know if this is just a general trend or maybe we see last few years, but it seems that new emerging technologies that are trending often create this boom of kind of floating the best ideas to the top. Like we've seen this with AI now. I guess everyone's paying their own AI service, and now it's only the best of that whole niche gets floated up to the top or funding, et cetera, with this whole recession. So that trend is just, I think, so interesting to see.
And especially considering if all the factors that go into it, so timing and as well as are people ready for the innovation to get incorporated in daily lives?
Yeah.
And so many other factors. What do you think will be next transformative thing for us and for entrepreneurs?
I don't know. As someone that, worked with natural language processing friends and applied some of those techniques in research over 20 years ago and did computer vision, which is a branch of AI, I'm maybe a little less gung-ho about the current generative AI boom or, level of interest. there's, you know, still there's some useful things there as always. And it's just, you know, maybe it's a little overbought or over published about in the press. Yeah, I think we'll always be making advances in automation of like how to use data intelligently for better outcomes and better tools. For people, it's just, it's never an overnight thing.
Yeah.
And I know this ChatGPT definitely seemed like an overnight thing. And it's just, you know, from my perspective, if you dig a little bit under the surface, it's less of a seismic shift and more of a gradual shift in the tools that we've had. Yeah, just like, you know, AI as a buzzword was, you know, like, I think the FTC just today maybe or yesterday came out with a notice that they're actually going to crack down on how often people use the term AI in their advertising.
Oh, really?
That's pitches, yeah. They're going to check whether you actually have any approach AI.
Oh, yeah, and especially mainstream and hopping on trends is not going anywhere, and it's going to accelerate.
It just keeps, like, there's just something going, and everyone tries to ride that way to say, oh, well, yeah, now we use AI, too. And I think that's, like, the pivotal point that people, they gain traction to, right? But instead, it's like, what actual service are you providing?
And a lot of people are trying to kind of fight it and go against and fight those trends, but I feel like maybe it's a good thing to hop on those trends. A lot of people, like, it's very hard to differentiate which trends are good to hop on and which are not, which are going to flop.
How do you differentiate those? I get to be armchair philosopher right now. Sometimes trends and booms are good things, right? Like the tech bubble in 2000, you know, which I lived through a little bit. I was just coming out of undergrad the first time around then. That, even after the bubble burst, we were left with lots, you know, more bandwidth and technical infrastructure that we didn't have beforehand. So there were positive side effects from it. But contrast that with crypto, where it's a gambling market and we attracted young households that didn't have wealth to start off with. And, you know, with the hope of lottery tickets, where it was really like a one-way street from their wallets to wealthy you know, VC and crypto or early people in crypto's wallets, that hasn't really had positive side effects to me so far. There's like a great outside cryptocurrency, there's a great opportunity for distributed ledgers in countries and environments where there isn't a solid rule of law and where you don't have institutions that people can trust. But the like the amount of venture funded activity going towards that has been pretty small.
Yeah.
Whereas in the tech boom, we had lots of the capital go to this these infrastructure needs, as well as things like pets.com Super Bowl adverts, which is a, you know, a waste in terms of social welfare. So there's booms, I think, that have useful societal benefits, like no matter whether the boom's right or not. And then there's ones that you sort of can see aren't having that boom. Yeah, AI probably falls more in the infrastructure, you know, the tech bubble category. Like, clearly there's lots of, you know, productive uses of computers we can talk to or that can, you know, prompt us. And we can converse with, you know, conversationally in terms of, like, versus requiring people to learn a programming language, right? It's just, it's making things more accessible. Yeah, so I've got good hopes about the AI, and even if it, I might think of it as overbought. But yeah, there's just, as a young person, like choosing whether to be a trend chaser rather than a contrarian. Yeah, one is your motivation and like, okay, do I enjoy this thing? Do I want to like grow gambling casinos if it's crypto? And, you know, I'll just be opinionated on that. or like, do I enjoy, you know, automating conversations? So there's like, are you just personally motivated by it? And then it's like, what do I get in terms of my investment in this space? And the human capital, like, right, there are returns on, because you're actually doing real work in AI versus, you know, maybe coming up with an NFT meme or a graphic that might not be, I wouldn't, as an old man, I don't see that as such a wise investment of your human capital. But
But before you decide whether you want to be a train chaser or be on the contra side, you absolutely have to actually make the decision to actually take the risk and go for it.
Yeah.
And so kind of for our final question, what is your advice to entrepreneurs who are kind of dissuaded from pursuing the risk?
Just do it. Yeah, just do it. Stop thinking about it. Stop asking your friends. There's only one way to learn, and that's by jumping out the plane and constructing the parachute on your way down.
I love that. I'm not gonna lie. I think it's so funny because there's so many booming, you know, trends, et cetera. People think, oh, maybe this is my time to be an entrepreneur now because I'm riding this way, whatever. But oftentimes when it's stagnant, they say, maybe, you know, I don't want to be an entrepreneur. It's not cool and whatnot. But I actually love that, but on the way down, because people have this, you know, sort of duality between structure or execution, right? And I think structure comes with the execution. And I think that's very true.
And a lot of people are also dissuaded by being so convinced that there is a better time. This is not the right time. Mm-hmm. There's a better time
out
there.
That's so true.
And the postponing of just going out is not going to make you any younger. And
it's sort of a question of commitment. Like, you might be doing the same things. Like, you might be talking to customers and exploring whether someone will pay you for this thing or that thing.
Mm.
But just telling your friends and your family, I'm starting a business, or I started a business yesterday, I am pursuing the startup idea.
Yeah.
Like, mentally and emotionally jumping out of the plane is huge. And so you just do that. And that's what you're doing, and making the clear switch that you're no longer looking for an investment banking position.
is
what you're doing. And being committed to it. And it's a, you know, like one-way doors versus two-way doors. It is a two-way door. You know, you're like, you can give up. That is always an option, and you can go on to something else. But at least to have tried it, you know, like when you're on your deathbed, everything's old and gone, you know. Like, what would you have rather that you did when you had the opportunity and you thought that there was a great idea or there was something that you wanted to change about the world?
I wish I jumped out of the plane without a parachute.
It's funny, Mike even mentioned the same thing. He was like, I think the risk now, that doesn't outweigh the regret you'll feel later. Yeah.
Yeah. Better to have tried and lost, right, than to have never tried at all.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for coming on. Pleasure to have you.
So happy to talk to you and to hear all your thoughts, entrepreneurship, and just in general. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'll look forward to listening to everyone else that you have
on. Of course. All right.